And here we are reading through, excuse me, Journey Home with Dr. Kenneth Wapnick, and it's a study of the obstacles to peace from A Course in Miracles. And we've been doing this, what, for about 8 months, 9 months?
Something like that, yeah. Now, it was last fall, I think, yeah.
So yeah,
early winter, late fall, I think.
Somewhere, yeah. Anyway, we're about 10 pages into the book. And
actually, about 90 pages.
About nine pages.
A whopping 90. So at this rate, we should be finished in about 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe by that time we'll have recognized the truth about ourselves and gone home, and there's no more reading of books. But
I'm not going to set up too many expectations, but I think it's helpful to read and be consistent, right?
It is, absolutely. And that's the main thing that we do, is just maintain consistency by remembering and doing the same thing day after day after day after day, and not forgetting our purpose, as today's lesson is all about.
Exactly. I can remember what my purpose is.
Yes. And
so read that?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, this is lesson 257. Let me remember what my purpose is. If I forget my goal, I can be but confused, unsure of what I am, and thus conflicted in my actions. No one can serve contradicting goals and serve them well, nor can he function without deep distress and great depression. Let us therefore be determined to remember what we want today, that we may unify our thoughts and actions meaningfully and achieve only what God would have us do this day. Father, forgiveness is your chosen means for salvation. Let us not forget today that we can have no will but yours, and thus our purpose must be yours as well if we would reach the peace you will for us. So to me, that first paragraph is another one of those easy to level confused, but it's really just, you know, the author of the course meeting us where I think we're at, and suggesting it in phrases of what God would have us do. Well, God wouldn't have us do anything on the level of form, but doing in terms of choosing the teacher of forgiveness and then practicing forgiveness in our minds, that's the doing that's being referred to. And then the second paragraph clarifies that pretty nicely. Huh?
It does. And also, it's kind of a hint. You know, Jesus gives us a lot of really good clues and hints when he says to us, if you're not doing your purpose, if you're serving a contradicting goal, then you will be distressed and depressed. Mm-hmm. And deeply distressed and depressed. And right. So anytime I'm feeling distressed or depressed, that is a hint to me that, oh, I must have a goal that is not the goal that God would have me have. I must be following a goal that doesn't jive with my real purpose. Mm-hmm. And I can switch my goal.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say, and it's a subtle difference in the cosmic scheme of things, but it's a big difference in our lives. So in our lives, what we change is going from depressed to deep rest, right?
Ah, I like that. From depressed to deep rest. I love it.
Should we pick up where we left off?
Absolutely.
Well, I do have one announcement to make.
Sure.
And I was visiting a study group in Ashland, Oregon, which is beautifully facilitated by Sally McCurgan, and she's been doing this for about a decade at least now. And I used to attend, actually more than that. But anyway, I used to attend that regularly on Friday mornings, and I just happened to be going through Ashland, Oregon, Thursday evening and Friday morning, so... I'll attend that group, and I got to see some friends I hadn't seen in years, and had a lot of fun sharing with everyone, and meeting a few new course students that I didn't know, and or hadn't met in person. And since I have a Wednesday study group that I attend online, and some of the people there that I had only met online. Anyway, during that 2-hour period, Tamara Morgan, and who is the daughter of Judy Scutch Whitson, and Dr. Bob Rosenthal, another wonderful hour-plus conversation that they shared from the Foundation for Inner Peace on, you know, basically practicing the course. And it's this is, I think, the fourth or fifth in the Let's Discuss series of videos that they're recording and then sharing with everyone. I put the links to that on the ACIMblog.com and the FIP and several other websites, probably a couple dozen of them. And if you look at the weekly thought graphics, you can find the links to how to sign up for those. And I will also be posting tomorrow. I'll update the links and if I have the link ready. Anyway, but you can subscribe to these, and they're just really excellent. And the people there said, "Wow, that was great! I'm so glad you brought your laptop and set it up and shared this with everyone," because we just took the last half of this 2-hour study group to watch the video, and everybody really enjoyed it, so including me. I'll post that on ACIM blog, but also on the ACIMblog.com Facebook page. So,
but
you might enjoy watching these excellent videos and conversations from Foundation for Inner Peace.
See, I had to talk to Bob and Tam and see if they would mind if I played those on Gather. I'm sure they wouldn't.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, sure. Yes. I'll, if you don't have their contact info, I'll get it to you.
Get it to me, yeah, because yeah. I would love that. And since they're not charging anything for it, I'm assuming, so it wouldn't be that we were, taking something away by playing it, but I would sure... those are the kind of conversations that I love to have on Gather. Since I play a lot of recordings, it's always nice to have something new, and it's very refreshing to hear from different points of view. So, give me that info, and I will contact them, and maybe we'll be playing that here. And I love
that sounds
idea.
Great. I'll email you and copy them.
Cool, very cool. All right. So I have no announcement other than I am still making some great progress, I think. I don't know. I can't tell my progress from my defeats. But I
that right there is great progress. If we recognize that, so you're making great progress, Lynn.
Yeah. So I have been defeated by the internet and all Zoom and all these different things. But yesterday we did have Reverend Tony Ponticello came because he couldn't get into Pal Talk because of his Mac wouldn't let him in. And we had him in here on Zoom, and it worked fairly well. There were some glitches that I'm going to have to try to figure out. But, you know, it was kind of cool that he was able to come on Zoom and be in Pal Talk. And the way that I do it is that I put Pal Talk in the screen share so that the Pal Talk screen is on the screen share. So if people write things on Pal Talk, on this Pal Talk screen, it shows up on the Zoom screen. And then if people write things in the Zoom chat, I can copy them and paste them into the Pal Talk room so that people can see the chat from there. So it's a little, you know, cumbersome.
There may be a way to tie that together in an automated way with tools like Zapier and things like that. So we can talk offline about that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what I'm thinking. There's got to be a better way. And
where have we heard that before?
And together we will find it.
Exactly.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. All right. So, we're still in our book, The Journey Home, and we're talking about special relationships and guilt and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm thinking...
Hey, we've only got about 12 pages to go for part 2.
Woohoo!
We might get into that in early fall. early autumn. should I pick up where we left off?
Yeah, pick up where we left off, and I'll catch up to you.
For those who have a hard copy of Ken's wonderful book, The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and A Course in Miracles, by Ken Wapnick, Ph.D., we left off at the top of page 90, the first full paragraph, which begins, "It is this welcoming of love at the table of communion that Jesus truly promised us. Whatever it was that he originally said or meant in terms of the gospel account of the Last Supper, if indeed he said anything at all, the blessing of the bread and its sharing certainly could not have meant sharing of his literal body, since, as we will see later on, the body is nothing. Therefore, why would he share something that has no value?" This passage, as so many others in A Course in Miracles, provides us with a totally different interpretation of the words that Christians traditionally have attributed to Jesus, and unfortunately used as a means, however unconscious this intent was, to justify their own thought system of separation, judgment, and specialness. These words from the text mean that Jesus would share his love with all members of, emphasis on the word all, members of the Sonship of God, not just select or special people, and with no conditions. We would know his presence when we choose to have him enter into the special relationships in our lives. This uniting with Jesus and all the Sonship is the only true communion, and this joining, which has nothing to do with separate bodies, is the only sane and loving interpretation that can be given to the gospel statements. It is the joining in our minds that reflects the greater joining of God and Christ. Join not your brother's dreams, but join with him where you join his Son the Father is. So the previous section was talking about communion and coming together and the symbolism of sharing a meal kind of thing.
Right, and it's not the ritualistic cannibalism that I grew up with in the Catholic Church. And you'd go to communion, and of course we were very strict on Sunday breakfast. I mean, you did not eat at church because you had to be fasting to take communion. Nowadays, they don't care about any of that stuff. But
now you just have to be fasting to take a blood test.
Yeah, there you go. But
to get blood rather than consume it.
So, you know, we'd go to church on Sunday morning, and if you didn't have anything to eat or drink before you went, you were like, my mouth would be dry. So I have allergies. And gosh, the horror of taking communion and having Jesus getting stuck on the roof of my mouth, and me sitting in the pew trying to force Jesus down my throat, you know, that
I never thought of it in those terms.
I'm sure a lot of people have that same thing. I'm sure I'm not the only one, because, you know, when you're a kid,
I'll bet a lot of people gag on the ideas that Jesus puts in A Course in Miracles.
But yeah,
but that's just the ego reaction to
exactly
to having its fake identity threatened.
Oh my gosh! But yeah.
Well, in keeping with that, I just had while you were talking, I turned my mic off and had a bite of my muesli with pecans and strawberries. So
yum! I like muesli a lot. Do you make your own?
No, I haven't in the years past made granola.
Buy it in the box at the
store. Lately,
spot.
I've just been buying it from the store.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. I mean,
it's all the same, right?
It's all the same. Yeah, what my brother makes the same. It's the same thing. I'm seeing that more and more every day. But you know, Jesus is talking about the joining in our minds. That is the greater joining of God and Christ. And I love this quote from chapter 28 that says, "Join not your brother's dreams, but join with him. And where you join, his Son, the Father is." It's the same thing that Jesus said in the Old Testament, where two or more of you are gathered in my name, I will be there. And that's what Jesus is saying right here. Whenever we join the two, that God is with us. Of course, God is with us all the time.
So right now, as we share our inspiration from the Course, and anyone else who's tuning in and resonates with the content of what we're sharing, we're all participating in that. And to the degree that we're off kind of doing our own thing, our own special separate interests, and engaging the dream of substitution, you know, it doesn't mean that we've harmed perfect oneness. It just means that we've excused ourselves from peace in a temporary dream of that has had no effect on reality.
Exactly. Thank God. Thank God it's not possible. Mm-hmm. That we cannot be changed. And of course, that's part of what the topic of special relevance talks about before these lessons that we're on, really about what is sin. And you know, basically, you know, he's saying, you know, sin is actually the imagination or the thought that you can change yourself or you could change God.
We could make a separate self and have it stick. Well, we in our dreams, in your dreams, we appear to have done this, but it has had no effect on reality. It has no effect on the eternal, infinite, beyond space and time, true identity that we all are and share. You know, that's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh my God.
Even if we appear to be, most of the time, somewhat oblivious to it.
Yeah, and then what a great assurance that is. That is probably, for me, you know, whenever somebody says to me, well, how come you're so, you know, happy about this, or how come, you know, this seems so easy for you, or, you know, people have a lot of, you know, things that they say. And I can truly say, because I know that no matter what I do, I cannot screw up God's plan. I could never have left God. God would never leave me. I'm happy because I know that I can't change God, and I can't be what I am. Truly could never have been subverted or perverted or turned into this being, this body, this person, this personality, this world that I perceive. That could never, ever actually be. Because if God could be changed, then yeah, you know, this world can be real. But God cannot be changed. And I cannot be changed. And I'm grateful for that. That's the only thing really we should be grateful for. Thankful to God that He still remembers us as we are. Remembers who we are, what we are, what He made, and that can't be changed. What a gift that is. So you want me to read on, or you?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So I was just gonna share,
yes,
one
please.
Thing that what you shared reminded me of. Yesterday in the study group before we started watching the FIP video, one of the participants in the class who I hadn't seen in quite a few years, Mike, I said right before he read from chapter 13, the first part, one of my favorite lines, which I think is on the surface sounds really challenging and austere, but when you think about what it really means, it's exactly the opposite. And that line is, if this were the real world, God would be cruel, implying that you know, this, we've made up a horrific dream in which we appear to be separate from each other and from God and from all that is in a profound way, and we don't recognize the extent of the angst and the guilt and the fear of imagined fear. I mean, it's this unconscious, unfounded guilt, but and fear and sin, that, you know, this whole complex of the ego's misthought that we've bought into. But we don't recognize the depth of it until we just start looking at the contents of our minds and looking over and over and over again at the stuff that surfaces, in any given moment on any given day, and recognize, if I'm not at peace, if I'm not perfectly at peace, I'm still choosing the wrong teacher. I'm still choosing the teacher of separation that says it was possible in this dream, and that's what takes us out of that dream, to have made up a world where we appear to be separate and separate from the creator of all, which is the ultimate oneness that we all are and share. And it just didn't happen. And that's the the fundamental metaphysics of the Course that changes everything and makes forgiveness possible.
That's a fact, Jack.
All right.
We can't change God. And God didn't make this, so hooray, hooray. So here from the Obstacles to Peace, chapter 19 of Course in Miracles, Jesus says, I am made welcome in the state of grace, which means you have at last forgiven me, for I became the symbol of your sin, and so I had to die instead of you. And that's a pretty profound statement, Jesus saying. And, you know, the idea of having to forgive Jesus is kind of crazy to most people. It was crazy to me when I first heard it. But the statement, I am made welcome in the state of grace, which means you have at last forgiven me, for I became the symbol of your sin. And so I had to die instead of you. And, you know, that's what we say. You know, Christ died for us. Jesus died for our sins. And, you know, because I'm so bad, Jesus had to die. And, you know, oh man, am I ever a bad person and I deserve punishment for that because, you know, Jesus is God's son. He shouldn't have to die. But, you know, what he's saying here is that we forgive the idea that he was punished. When we forgive the idea that somehow or the other Jesus had to be punished because of my sins, and we recognize that what is sin? Sin is, it doesn't even exist. It's an aberration. It's a thought that something could be wrong in the kingdom of heaven. And when we give up the idea, and as you know, he tells us, let all things be exactly as they are, stop complaining, stop criticizing, stop thinking that something could be different or should be different. When we can come into a place of just acceptance of what is and not trying to rearrange or change it, recognizing that nothing has gone wrong, then there was no purpose for Jesus to die. There was no reason for Jesus, the man who walked the earth, to have been murdered. He wasn't murdered so that I could be redeemed. and so, you know, I don't have to be ashamed or afraid or feel like, you know, somehow or the other it was my fault. You know, people, they would tell us that. It's your fault Jesus died. You know, little children who absolutely knew nothing of the world, you know, being told that it was our fault that Jesus died, that's a pretty bad burden to put on people. Or to take on yourself, but to recognize that he didn't die for my sins. You know, the only purpose of any of that was to prove to me that he could not die, and that death is not real, and that you know, we are all the same in that same being. Death is not a part of our life, our real life. Anyway, as I ramble on, just recognizing that, you know, for that I don't have to feel ashamed or afraid or be guilty for Jesus having died. It's not my fault, and it has nothing to do with my sins. Basically,
yeah, because there is no sin. And as you're sharing that, it occurred to me that one of the things that probably, perhaps unintentionally, I think was accurate in that storytelling, which is, you know, involved in so much of Christianity, and interpretation, and kind of like the telephone game, where, you know, after so many centuries, or in this case millennia, at least a couple of millennia, you know, we've got the story so distorted and so, you know, abridged, revised, misquoted, and otherwise, you know, inaccurate, that we kind of miss a lot. But one thing I think kind of sort of comes through in that story is that even if you were to believe that, the I died for your sins, that sort of implies an intentionality. It doesn't usually go, that Romans killed me, and I just figured, oh, I could use that to atone for your sins. No, it was I died, meaning it's an intentional thing. Well, and metaphorically, I mean, another way to take that is we're all consciously or unconsciously choosing everything that seems to happen to us, and that right there gets us back to the mind. So even that part of the story of intentionality gives us an out to the insanity of the ego's version of the story, which basically suggests that sin is real and something really happened, and there really was a figure named Jesus that was separate from God, and there really was a figure named Bruce, and then one named Lynn that was separate from God, and all those stories combined make up just this vast illusion, as the Course describes it, which includes space, time, individuality, and the whole sin, guilt, fear complex.
All that stuff. Yep, all that stuff. So that if that's not real and that doesn't exist, then, you know, what is there to forgive? So Ken says, these sentences are especially significant because they explain why Jesus states in a few places in A Course in Miracles that he needs us to forgive him. Within the ego system, perfect love or perfect guiltlessness and innocence is a sin, while sin is holy and wholly true. Holy, H-O-L-Y, and holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. True, as described in the following passage. This is from chapter 19. A major tenet in the ego's insane religion is that sin is not error but truth, and that it is innocence that would deceive. The idea of sin is wholly sacrosanct to its thought system and quite unapproachable except with reverence and awe. It is the most, quote-unquote, holy concept in the ego system, lovely and powerful, wholly true and necessarily protected, with every defense at its disposal. Text chapter 19, section 2. So Ken says, sin is the ego's proof that the separation from God is real. And this, then, demonstrates that the specific individuality of the Son is real as well. For this belief to continue, the belief in sin must be preserved at all costs, which is accomplished through the dynamic of projection. Sin is thus first made real and then projected onto someone else. This, in turn, reflects the principle of one or the other, in italics, one or the other. If I am sinful, you must be innocent. But if I try to give you my sin, then I am sinless. Therefore, innocent of all charges God might make on me. So, basically, we say, it wasn't me. I didn't do that. I wasn't the one who crucified Jesus. That was the Romans. That was the Jews. It wasn't me.
I just get a quick aside on that. The one or the other principle is the ego's exclusive or logic. Years ago, when I was studying electronics, you learn about the circuits that make up, the digital electronic world that we now take for granted. And there's things like AND gates and NAND gates and NOR gates and OR gates, and one of the ones that occasionally comes up is an XOR or exclusive OR gate, which basically says if one or the other is true but not both, then if the result of that gate is true, you know, the result of that electrical signal is active or high or whatever you want to call it. So it's really based on you can't have both. You can't have both kind of thinking. And so but in truth, if we're all one, then if any part is left out, if any part is excluded, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. So the only win-win thought system is the AND thought system, ultimately, because that one ensures that both have to be valid, and we have to validate the innocence of everyone in this massive and gate, if you will, in our mind, that basically is what I think forgiveness is all about, is we basically undo all of the negations of innocence that the ego presents and say, you know, that's just not true, because behind the behavior, behind the form, behind the dream drama, there is this perfect innocence. And that's what this curriculum really asks us to do, is to practice looking for that and seeing that and overlooking the form to find the content in the mind, which is the pure innocence. And we need Holy Spirit's help with that, to see, you know, that shared interest. And that's why in, you know, the Manual for Teachers, the two themes are shared, as Ken Wapnick brilliantly points out in his journey through the manual, the two themes are shared interests and how they undo the separate interests of the ego, and listening to Holy Spirit, which in and of itself is the antithesis of ego thinking. So.
Exactly. Well, I was eating a piece of toast, so... Oh, you were speaking. So the whole idea of the only way I can be innocent is if you are guilty completely shifts my whole idea of sin. And it just makes it, you know, somebody has to be to blame. There has to be someone to blame. And when I practice true forgiveness, I recognize that there's nothing has gone wrong. So there's nothing to blame for. You know, this has never happened. Is the out for that exclusive or? Because it completely negates necessity for the or gate. It negates the or gate.
So we need the ego's. A thought system instead of needing it.
That's right. All right. So the next paragraph, Ken says, and so when the sinless Jesus appeared within the Son's dream of sin, the ego projected its own blasphemy onto him, who then had to be killed to protect the ego system of separation and individuality. Earlier in the text, Jesus teaches, quote, to the ego, the guiltless are guilty. And that's in text chapter 13. And then later in that same section, he continues referring to himself. When the ego, quote, was confronted with the real guiltlessness of God's Son, it did attempt to kill him. Again, in text chapter 13, section 2. In the warped insanity of the ego mind, reflected in the five laws of chaos, text chapter 23, Jesus must be perceived as sinful and guilty, deserving of punishment. Jesus says, I became the symbol of your sin, and so I had to die instead of you. That's a quote. And so he must literally be forgiven for what he did not do. On a deeper level, we can understand that we must forgive Jesus not for who he was, not for who he was not, one who sins, judges, demands specialness and sacrifice, etc., but for who he truly is, the manifestation of the Holy Spirit's love. It is this fact that the ego holds against him, for in his all-loving presence, the reflection of the abstract love of God, the ego's individuality disappears. So basically, Jesus, the symbol of sinlessness, made the ego look bad. And the ego does not like to look bad. So it just, it has to destroy anything that shows to it, not, you know, that actually, shows the real, evil of the ego. But it just looks like it looks bad. And
how dare you challenge my shabby nothingness?
Exactly. And so, you know, it has to destroy, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, if you're the let me think of a good, you know, okay, You're the captain of the basketball team in high school, and you're the big man on campus, and everybody thinks you're the greatest guy. And then to your school, maybe this is, you know, 50 years ago, a young man named Shaquille O'Neal comes to your school and joins the basketball team, and all of a sudden you're not the big kahuna anymore. You know, here's somebody here who's bigger kahuna than you are. And so, you know, anybody with any kind of common sense would say, well, great, we have a better player on our team now, and our team's going to be great now. But the big man on campus says, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this guy. And you know, do whatever he could to undermine that. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it, any sort of competition that the ego sees is going to try to get rid of. And so Jesus was, the concept even of Jesus was such a huge competition to the ego that it had, you know, he had to die. You know, you can't, he was dangerous. So that's, you know, kind of how I see it. And the fact is, he wasn't dangerous. He was there to help the team. And, you know, if we had only recognized that he was there to help the team and joined with him, then, you know, this the world we see would be completely different now. It wouldn't be, I mean, even historically, if you believed in history and one thing causes another, a cause and effect in the world or whatever, it would have been a radical change. But we're being offered that same opportunity for radical change right now. And, you know, Shaq is on my team, and I'm happy.
Yeah, we're all on the same team, and it's only the ego that suggests that there's there could be another team. And ultimately, it's through shared interests, which is why, in some of Ken Wapnick's talks, he talks about how, you know, even if you're working together with someone to, you know, do something horrible, you know, in the world's terms, you know, whether it's robbing a bank or, you know, blowing up a bridge or, you know, some stupid thing, right?
Building an atomic bomb. Or
yeah, exactly. But it's the spirit of coming together that is at the heart of the undoing of the ego, because in order to truly collaborate, in order to truly have a cooperative, egalitarian, sharing spirit, you're eroding the very fabric of the ego's premise, which is that separation is possible. And, you know, when we share kindness and a willingness to look past what appears and see the untarnished, unblemished, perfect innocence that is behind everyone and everything, and practice that, that's when ego's alarms go off big time, because its very foundational premise is being threatened.
Danger, danger, Will Robinson.
Got it. you want to finish that paragraph?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so... Jesus must be perceived at, let's see, where am I at? In the warped, let me move this up. Okay, insanity of the ego mind reflected in the five laws of chaos, Jesus must be perceived as sinful and guilty, deserving of punishment. He says, I became a symbol of your sin, and so I had to die instead of you. And so he must literally be forgiven for what he did not do. On a deeper level, we can understand that we must forgive Jesus, not for who he was not, one who sins, judges, demands specialness and sacrifice, etc., but for who he truly is, the manifestation of the Holy Spirit's love. It is this fact that the ego holds against him, for in all his all-loving presence, the reflection of the abstract love of God, the ego's individuality disappears, makes him look bad. A parallel passage concludes one of the later sections in the text on specialness. Forgive your Father, it was not his will that you be crucified. text chapter 24, section 3. What the ego really holds against God, as it does Jesus, is not that he will punish us, but that he does not. The ego holds against God that he's not punishing us. He does not even know the sin for which punishment would be the inevitable result. The absence of punishment undoes one of the ego's central lines of defense, as it is expressed in this wonderful summary of the ego's dynamics of guilt and punishment. Okay, and this is from text chapter 5. Again, I say text chapter 5, compared to chapter 4, which is really amazing, chapter 5 has a lot of the answers that people are always looking for and can never find in A Course in Miracles. Go and read chapter 5 and it'll answer a lot of questions for you. It says, quote, "The ego is the part of the mind that believes in division. How could part of God detach itself without believing it is attacking him? We spoke before of the authority problem as based on the concept of usurping God's power. The ego believes that this is what you did because it believes that it is you. If you identify with the ego, you must perceive yourself as guilty. Whenever you respond to your ego, you will experience guilt and you will fear punishment." And just real quick aside, if you are experiencing guilt and fearing punishment, you know exactly why that is. Jesus just explained it to us, because we're responding to our ego. And continuing, "The ego is quite literally a fearful thought. However ridiculous the idea of attacking God may be to the sane mind, never forget that the ego is not sane. It represents a delusional system and speaks for it. Listening to the ego's voice means that you believe it is possible to attack God and that a part of him has been torn away by you. Fear of retaliation from without follows because the severity of the guilt is so acute that it must be projected." Text chapter 5, section 5. This whole idea that we can attack God, it just, you know, the world, the mind will tell you, no, that's unforgivable and that's a bad thing. But then when you start realizing that every time you believe the ego, your mind is telling, the ego is telling you, you're attacking God. You are telling God no. And this is why you feel guilty. You may not recognize it. You may not say, "Well, you know, I'm afraid of, you know, I'm afraid for my body because I got cancer, and I'm worried that I'm going to be sick and I'm going to be, I'm going to go broke from paying medical bills and my family's going to suffer." And any belief that you have that's based on a belief about the body, the world, the being, the human that you think you are, believing that any of those things are possible is actually saying, you know, God does not live in this house. God does not live in this body. God does not live in this world. It really is an attack on God. When I believe that, you know, what I see is broken and can be broken, I'm saying God messed up. God made a mistake. And, you know, I used to think that, well, that's crazy. That's whacked. I would never say God made a mistake. But then I realized, I mean, that's my whole life, is pointing out God's mistakes. When I see suffering in the world, when I see, you know, hurricanes and refugees and global warming and starvation and my neighbor slapping his wife, or, you know, whatever it is that I see, believing that it's true, believing that it's real, believing that it's capable of having real effect, is saying God is helpless, useless, worthless. God has no say over anything. And that's an attack.
Yeah. And one of the, there's countless ways that we reenact that original tiny man idea, and of course refers to that frequently as the authority problem, which is really just a different way of saying that, you know, we believe that somehow we slam the door on God's face and you know, burn the bridge and essentially made up a world where entry by God was impossible. And within the dream context, that's actually accurate. But that's the important phrase there is within the dream context, because it's a dream. We couldn't have pulled that off, and I think that's why the course begins with nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, and herein lies the peace of God. So all the things that we made up as space, time, individuality, and the whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear is nothing more than an illusion that its basis is a threat. And sometimes we find, you know, if people say, well, I don't feel guilty or I don't feel afraid, you know, next time, just watch your mind. The next time you're on the freeway and behind you, you see red and blue lights flashing, and, you know, it might be a split second before you realize it was for some other car, or even if it is for your car, it's like, well, if you haven't done anything wrong in truth, then the unconscious guilt wouldn't even precipitate into a concern about, you know, behavior in the world either. I mean, it's like another example, you know, be getting a letter from the IRS or something, you know, just pick anything that you may have had, even just a momentary, you know, gulp or reaction to, and just look at the way the thought system behind the fear of retribution, the fear of, you know, quote unquote, an authority, you know, condemning and or punishing. It really is just a reflection of our projection of that punishing intent that we've never fully reconciled. And so when people say, well, I don't feel guilty, it's just say, well, just watch in a given day how many times you're upset or how many times you let someone else's confusion bother you. That came up in a conversation yesterday. I thought was a pretty interesting insight in the study group in Southern Oregon. It's like, you know, if you let somebody, if you are perturbed by the fact that someone else seems to be confused, guess whose confusion it is? Anyway, but I thought that was a really interesting insight. So
that is really, yeah. Well, yeah, and always remember, you know, I mean, it's just a constant looking at your own thinking. You know, it's a constant looking at my own mind and mm-hmm. questioning, where did that thought come from?
Yeah.
And it becomes pretty simple after a while to recognize that none of those thoughts come from God. Those are not God's thoughts at all. And either that or God is really insane. And if you accept that God is not insane, then you're going to accept that he's only thinking in a loving way. And, you know, if I'm not seeing love, then I'm looking at something else. I'm seeing through the ego. All right. Let's see here. So what happened here?
Oh. Should I read on where you left off?
Sure.
Okay. Returning to Jesus, we did finish that sentence.
Yes, yeah, we
okay.
did, yeah.
Returning to Jesus, we can therefore see in the world's reaction to him the fragmented shadow of the original decision by the Son of to reject the Holy Spirit's atonement principle in favor of the ego's glorification of its separated self. And so by, quote, forgiving, unquote, Jesus, we are really forgiving ourselves for the sin of rejecting love, which we projected onto him, thereby undoing the guilt that followed from our original decision to choose the ego. In the following description of this dynamic, for the purpose of this discussion, the word Jesus, in quotes, has been substituted for your brothers, in quotes, or others, in quotes. Attack could never promote attack unless you perceived it as a means of depriving you of something you want. Yet you cannot lose anything unless you do not value it, and therefore do not want it. This makes you feel deprived of it. And by projecting your own rejection, you then believe that Jesus is taking it from you. You must be fearful if you believe that Jesus is attacking you to tear the kingdom of heaven from you. This is the ultimate basis for all the ego's projection. Being the part of your mind that does not believe it is responsible for itself, and being without allegiance to God, the ego is incapable of trust, projecting its insane belief that you have been treacherous to your Creator. It believes that Jesus, who is incapable of this, as is as incapable of this as you are, is out to take God from you. Well, in this case, the ego's lowercase g God. Anyway, whenever a brother attacks another, that is what he believes. Projection always sees your wishes in others. If you choose to separate yourself from God, that is what you will think Jesus is doing to you. And that's adapted from chapter 7 in the text, section 7, paragraphs, or sentences 8 and 9. And then Ken concludes with, on first reading of the above, it might seem we really believe this of Jesus. And yet, if we are to believe his own teachings to us on the fourth and fifth laws of chaos, we cannot but believe this. The ego's principle of one or the other always holds within the dream of individuality, whether we are speaking of Jesus, Adolf Hitler, or the people we love and work with.
See, that gives us quite a range of of beings between Jesus and Hitler, and we might even think of some others in this modern times that might be the antithesis of goodness, and maybe Mother Teresa, and I don't know. I could think of a lot.
Well, I think of her as a pretty kind person.
Yeah, but
oh, you're talking about
there are beings here that we say this person is good and this person is bad, or this person is doing good things or this person is doing bad things, and any differentiation like that, anytime we're saying that there is a difference between the sons of God, even if we think that the differences are only the character in the dream, and the character in the dream isn't real, and so it doesn't count if I hate him. No, it doesn't work that way. Your character in the dream has a choice always to choose love or to choose hate. And, I find myself often choosing hate. I find myself often choosing anger. When I look and see things that seem to be so real and terrifying. And that's really all you have to watch. Watch your own mind and see how often you're choosing the opposite of love, which is not hate. Hate is not the opposite of love. There is no opposite to love. but the closest thing is fear.
Good point.
Fear.
Yeah,
if you're, exactly. If you're accepting fear, then you are rejecting love. And, we have a choice. And, this is what I always exhort, EXHORT, all teachers, students of A Course in Miracles, this book found you. You didn't find this book. This book found you. Back in the very beginning, when we have the Tiny Man idea, we recognize that there had to be an end to it. The Holy Spirit came to give us an out, and this book is the end of the universe, really. This book, if read and followed and accepted, and if we do as we're given instruction to do here, the ultimate thing is that the world is gone. The universe is gone. The aberration disappears. The dream no longer occupies our mind. And so, even if you're new to the Course, you just picked it up, you just found it, you just read Disappearance of the Universe or Return to Love or any other of those books and recognize, oh, A Course in Miracles, let me check that out. That's it. You're hooked. And you may put it down and not pick it up for 20 years, But when the time is right, you will pick it up. And when you pick it up and you begin doing the reading the text, doing the lessons, when you begin actually practicing forgiveness and learning what it is, that's the end. There's, you know, the end is sure. So there's you and I and everyone who's listening here, we have a instruction to remember our purpose and to do what we're here for, and you know, that's all we have to worry about. I don't have to worry about, you know, am I, you know, anything. I don't have to worry about anything. You know, if I get a guidance or direction to, you know, give you my last dollar, you know, I'll give it to you because I know that, you know, no matter what happens, that I will always have what I need. I will always be safe. I will always, nothing.
And also, go ahead.
Anyway. I was just going to go on and on about that.
You will always be safe, yeah. Because the safety that the Course refers to has nothing to do with form and has nothing to do with bodies or material provisions or money or anything like that. It has to do with spirit, and we get back to spirit through a decision in the mind to not identify with the realm of form. And it's never done in any kind of, you know, certainly a demanding or compulsory way. It's something that we all volunteered to do to undo the ego on some level of the mind that we often are not consciously aware of. But we knew that the only way out of the dream was to choose the teacher of kindness and learn about forgiveness. And for starting with ourselves, because ultimately that's the only place it's gonna work. And there's this infinite patience that's really behind this curriculum. That you know, there's no urgency in truth, but on the level of the mind where we think we're at, you know, it really is helpful. And I think that's why, you know, the curriculum that we're studying and practicing is truly helpful, because it really gives us a way to speed up the undoing of our misidentification with dream figures and really identify with the shared interests and ability to overlook the dream. I'm here in my quote unquote home in Oregon, on a street called Overlook. It reminds me whenever I think of that's my job, is to overlook the dream and to forgive myself, and as Ken is pointing out, forgive Jesus, you know, forgive that part of ourselves that ego would condemn, that represents the way home, what represents the journey back to source.
Exactly. And I mean, it's the key. We have the key. We have the lamp that can be used to dispel the darkness. And Overlook, wasn't that the name of the hotel in The Shining? I'm not, or maybe I'm wrong. I'll look it up. Anyway, we are about out of time here. I'm going to read this one last paragraph, and then we'll turn the mic over to Carrie and Iris.
Okay.
Therefore, having accused ourselves of abandoning Jesus, the ego turns this around so that Jesus would be seen as the one who abandoned us. He is the one who made all these promises to us, which he did not keep. He is the one who let himself be captured, mocked, humiliated, and finally killed. Hence, our different ways of looking at Jesus would reflect the different aspects of how the ego thinks, having nothing whatsoever to do with his reality, which remains sinless and pure, outside the world stream of crucifixion and death. Many of Helen's poems dramatically express this projection. The interested reader may consult, for example, The Ancient Love, Prayer for a House, and Holy Saturday from The Gifts of God. And speaking of Helen, I don't know if you got an email from Gary Renard today. You may have and may not have noticed it yet, but
probably the case.
He sent an email with a photograph of him and Cindy and this young woman whose name is Alenza, Alzina, and said that she is the reincarnation of Helen Schuckman. And I find this quite interesting that they're announcing this at this time. It says that she's started doing A Course in Miracles at the age of 7. And by the time she was 12, she was writing to Ken Wapnick and giving him advice. And at one point, Ken wrote to Judith Scutch, the president of the foundation, and said, "That's Helen. So I'm just one of several close friends who knew or know about Alzina." So I find this very interesting that this announcement is being made right now. And she's quite a lovely young lady. She looks tall.
There are photos of her on the FIP website if you have dived into the depth and breadth of all the content there, which is quite a lot. There's a whole page that has a number of photographs of her giving wonderful piano performances and a child prodigy, which is not, you know, certainly fits, you know, what you would think. Pardon?
I have seen that, but I didn't realize that it was the reincarnation of Helen.
Well, yeah, that was something that I think Art Nampersa suggested, and seems reasonable to me.
Very interesting.
What I've seen from so far, but yeah. But again, the important point is not that while here's a specific person, it's like, well, yeah, we all get a chance to you know, pick up where we left off, and there's absolutely nothing that really is holding us back, because at every moment, no matter which lifetime we appear to be living in, we have an opportunity to forgive and to complete the work of that classroom and go home. So.
Yeah. And I personally don't believe in reincarnation. So, and it's not that I disbelieve this in any way at all. It's just that my personal belief is that, yes, we do, you know, we continue to wander in the maze of illusion until we actually wake up from the dream. And so, the being that we called Helen, I don't think it still exists. I think that's a being that's a part of the dream. But somewhere along the line, another being came along that had shared those memories. And
it's probably more helpful to question the belief in incarnation altogether.
Exactly.
which Gary's teachers point out frequently.
Yeah, we're just wandering in a maze of dreams, and I may dream I'm a fish one day, and I may dream I'm, the Queen of England one day, or whatever, or Hitler, or whatever. But it's all just part of the dream, because we're all one mind. So. So there can't be individual persons. Anyway, enough of that. Thank you so much, Bruce Ross.
Likewise.
Wonderful talk, wonderful sharing, and it's time for Iris and Carrie, so I'm going to give up the mic and turn it over to you guys and run in there and turn off this recording. And let's see.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Yeah, somewhat feisty personality still. She hasn't gone too far. Lynn, that Overlook. Yeah, that was the name of the hotel in The Shining. You know, the inside parts of it, the part where they showed the interior of it, was filmed in Colorado, and all the exterior shots, the outside shots, were filmed up at Timberline Lodge at halfway up Mount Hood in Oregon. I went up there, and me and my mom, we stayed in there for a night one time, and I asked about the maze and stuff, and there was no maze. But they showed you a couple of the angles where the famous shots of the outside were filmed, and it still looks the same. Good morning, Iris. God morning, isn't it? Let's be thankful that we can choose again, forgive. Allow ourselves to overlook all the stories the mind wants us to tell, wants us to keep occupied. You always can choose peace. Choose again by not deciding. You know, we always are acting and going along with the stories that we've already decided are true, and that we follow the plot. We don't have to. Yeah, it's such wonderful news that I can just pause and let all of this crap just be undone in my mind, as long as I no longer want to value it. I don't have to stop valuing it before it'll happen. I just have to no longer want to value it and catch myself when my story is trying to prop up what it contains, trying to value the past and things in time and form bodies. You could just instantly just end time in the mind. Or you can shorten it so much that it's just this one instant right now. And instead of it being a tiny mad idea, it's a hopeful, happy idea that goes into eternity. It's where the time stops and the borderland and ending begins. Instead of a tiny mad idea drawn